Hey, everythingers, it's Tom. I'm trying that out. Everythingers. That, you let me know if that works. What you're listening to right now is the second and final test episode of the podcast, recorded all the way back in September of 2021. For those who don't know, before the podcast launched, we recorded two test episodes of the podcast with no intention of releasing them. They were just for us to get our bearings, figure out what we wanted the podcast to be like. But they both ended up being really great. This episode in particular has some of my favorite jokes and bits, and also some of the most absolutely bonkers facts I've ever learned, including not just what happens to spiders when they take recreational drugs, but why that study happened in the first place. And also the question in this episode is one that we accidentally keep referencing, so I'm glad we can finally share it with y'all. This is still a test episode, so for instance, at the end, you will hear us figure out in real time what we want the outro of the podcast to be. And also, this episode doesn't have a proper introduction, so if this is your first time, I'll do that right now. Hello, and welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting. Today, we're going to be learning about a science topic, answering a science question, and then hopping over into a miscellaneous topic. My name's Tom. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Ella and Caroline, and thank you so much for listening. I'll see you in the episode.
Okay, I'm going to listen to the... Oh! Oh. It's so nice. I literally like it. I just feel... It's so good. I was just about to start singing it, but then I just started listening to it. I don't think I know it well enough, but I'm going to try. I'm going to try. Ready? Do, do.
Oh my god. Oh, so you did figure a way to pipe in the audio, because that sounded exactly right, right?
That was so good.
Today I am doing part one, and I will be talking about animals on recreational drugs.
Yay! drugs.
Oh dear.
Carol's like, animals.
Oh no, animals on drugs. I'm very happy right now.
Tom?
Today's question is going to be, how many digits of pi do we actually need?
Need? Ooh, that's how exciting. None of them.
Yeah, none. Zero. Thank you. And I am doing a miscellaneous topic, which is going to be about drama in the art world.
Ooh.
Yay!
Wait.
You might know about it already.
Oh,
but...
man. I think I know what you're talking... Okay, does it... Oh, wait. Well,
I'm excited.
I really want to talk about it,
oh,
so
boy.
I'm doing it.
Okay.
Drama in the art world? Unheard of.
Would never happen. They're all so mature and grown up, you know?
It's all objective. Art. Notoriously objective.
I'm going to be talking about animals on recreational drugs. Recreational being recreational for humans, although they can be recreational for animals, as we will soon find out.
Ooh.
You two will already be familiar with this from my video on bees that I posted on TikTok.
You're a critically acclaimed TikTok.
I'm critically acclaimed TikTok about giving honeybees cocaine. I'm going to cover that again in more detail because at the time of posting that, I think videos were only 1 minute long, so I left out a bunch of stuff. But also because I thought, for the purpose of TikTok, people don't want to know the methodology of this paper. I mean, I do. And now you get to know.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking about how do you give a bee drugs? How do
you? You'll find
out.
I'm
so excited.
Probably like a friend of a friend at a party, you know? Like, there's that bee at the party.
Yeah, that everyone knows.
You're not surprised he brought cocaine to the party, but...
Maybe disappointed, but not surprised.
So this research comes from a paper called The Effects of Cocaine on Honeybee Dance Behavior by Baron et al. From 2009.
Already great.
I'll start by saying that cocaine is a natural insecticide and plant protective compound.
Really?
It does it by disrupting the motor system of insects. So it's produced by the coca plant as a defense mechanism. That's why it's
there. Wow!
That's super interesting. I had never thought
about that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I think it's super cool.
So that's why the paper was done, is that like people wanted to use it as an insecticide elsewhere?
No, I still don't know why the paper was done. A bunch of people in the comments of my TikTok were like, oh, they probably are doing this because it's an insecticide. And I was looking at it, I was like, no, I don't. They didn't say that.
They're just doing it for the funsies.
It's like the answer you give to your professor versus like the real answer that you have. You're like, oh, no, I don't know.
I'll tell you what they said about why they did it, and you can decide if you think this is a legitimate reason. Because so in humans, cocaine triggers the dopamine reward system in our brain. Mm-hmm. And there are many similarities in neurochemical systems between insects and humans.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, these researchers wanted to see if cocaine's mode of action could be similar between insects and humans. So if it could have the same rewarding effects on bees that it can have in mammals. Why? I truly do not know.
Yeah, I'm just left with like a further why. More why, yeah. Please.
I mean, I am curious.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think about it? And when we get to the end of this bit, you can tell me why you think that they wanted to know. Sometimes scientists just want to know things. Maybe it will be useful one day. Who knows? But before I get into the research, I'll just remind you guys what the waggle dance is, which is the cutest thing. It's the dance that honeybees do to show other bees where the flowers are. They move in a certain direction, and they wiggle their bums at a certain speed and duration, right? So the direction the bees move in relation to the hive indicates the direction of the flowers, and the duration of waggle part of the dance indicates the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And something I thought about that was really interesting from reading this paper that I'd never heard of is that bees don't just automatically dance when they return to the hive.
Mm.
They decide whether or not to dance based on how profitable their foraging trip was. They have that capacity.
Wow.
That's so cool.
Isn't it? They're incredibly sophisticated.
You don't expect that from something like a bee.
Yeah, it's like if you brought like really bad art to like an art critique and you see everyone else's like great art and you're just like, no, I didn't bring anything today, actually. I actually lost my art. It's not here. You can't see it. If it's not good enough, they'll just like ignore it.
Yeah, I thought that it would be like every single bee just did it and then the other bee's like, well, that doesn't look that good, so I won't go. But no, they're like, no, I'm not going to show you. Was it really good?
I didn't do anything. It's fine. That's so interesting.
Oh, okay. One more fact is this is an actual thing. The part of the hive where the bees dance is called the dance floor.
I want to be a bee so badly.
It's so good. Okay, now that we have established that bees are very cute and smart, on to giving bees drugs. So, Caroline, you were wondering how they gave the bees the drugs. They dissolved it in a specific solvent that can penetrate the bee's cuticle, so the hard bit on the bee.
Interesting.
And then they applied it to the thorax of the bees using a glass microcapillary, so just like a tiny, tiny pipette.
Just because my brain is thinking about it, how did they have like a contraption to hold the bee, or is it just like a quick like, there's a bee, squirt?
That is such a good question. I didn't see that in the paper. Like when I saw the administration part, it said that's how they applied it, but they didn't say if they held them. Maybe if it's just a single drop, then they don't need to.
Yeah.
Because bees you can keep them still for a little while.
Mm.
So the results, I'm not going to get too deep into this. It was a long paper and we have other animals to talk about.
Yeah.
But after cocaine administration, the bees, they danced more often and they increased the duration of their dancing. So all of this shows that they're overestimating to the other bees the value of the flowers they found. So like I said to you, they don't always dance and now they're almost always dancing, regardless of whether or not it was good.
That's incredible.
Dude, you gotta check out these flowers. They're so cool.
They also experience withdrawal after stopping chronic use, and they perform more poorly in normal waggle dancing and other skills afterwards.
Interesting.
Which is sad.
How did they express withdrawal? Was that just from like dancing less, or were there other things as well? Were they like looking for the drugs?
I think it was generally like whatever the B version of lethargic is.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Just generally poor performance.
That's so interesting. That's
so interesting, because those feel like such human things, yeah. Right? Like excitedness and withdrawal, and to realize that they can be done, or a bee can feel similarly, is very, I don't know what that says about either the complexity of bees or the simplicity of our brains, you know? It's interesting.
The reward and kind of the reward processing and withdrawal processing our brains is exceptionally simplistic and similar between animals. I mean, I say simplistic, we still don't know how a lot of it works, but it's very similar. So the researchers thought that this was actually due to the reward processing pathways and not the motor system disruption that cocaine also has on insects, because the bees were otherwise fine.
Okay.
Wow.
The waggle dancing wasn't, because their motor system was disrupted. And like I said, I still do not understand the benefit of this study, other than general knowledge.
Other than podcast content.
Yeah. Like, I can think of reasons, but surely if those were the reasons, they would have mentioned it in the paper. Like, if it was something to do with using cocaine as an insecticide, they would have mentioned that in the paper.
They do talk about it as an insecticide, but it's known as an insecticide already, and it's known to work on bees. Mm. It wasn't about understanding. Basically, the conclusion of the paper said, so, yeah, it's an insecticide, and also a side effect might be that the insects get high. And that was...
Because, like, I would want to then from there go on and be like, how does that impact, like, the hive as a whole? Does that mean that they get less pollen because they're putting all of their resources into less fruitful pollen collection? Does that impact them in the long run?
You should become an entomologist, Caroline.
My granddad keeps confusing the word ecologist and entomologist, so he's told everybody that I'm going to become an entomologist, when in fact I'm going to be an ecologist.
I'd be so disappointed if you told me you were going to be an entomologist and then you're like, oh no, it's actually ecology.
Sorry, it's just trees, you know.
Just trees.
So yeah, like, that would be the reason that I would assign, but like, I feel like that would have been mentioned, you know?
And what I should have done is look deeper into what these researchers' studies are. I didn't look at what their background is. So there might be further reasons that the lab is doing. So maybe I'll look into that and let you guys know.
Future podcaster. Yeah.
I'll do an update in the next podcast, although I can't, because that'll be the first episode and no one will know what we're talking about.
But I mean, I'm curious if the other animal research papers have other explanations, or is it all based on the bee? They were like, we just wanted to do that one, but now, and it's just
wanted to get a bee high and see what happened, you know? Yeah, like
these others, some of these animals coming up have better reasons, some do not.
Okay.
Let's see how it goes, because bees aren't the only insects we've given cocaine to.
Interesting.
Researchers at Ohio State University tried to find out why caterpillars of the Aloria nomisi moth are insensitive to cocaine. It's not toxic to them.
Whoa.
They're one of the only insects that it's not an insecticide for.
Wow.
I'm already more on board with the reasoning behind this paper.
The study found that their dopamine transporters are still sensitive to it, so it suggests that the insensitivity comes from other methods, and this paper hadn't established what those are. This research might have moved on from there, but I couldn't find anything.
Hmm.
It did lead me to wonder, does that mean the caterpillars are getting high, like the bees?
They're having a great time.
Yeah, but not dying.
Oh, I hope so.
Obviously, the bees in that other study didn't die. It was a very low concentrations, but the caterpillars are like, they're just eating the leaves of the coca plants. Like, they can eat cocaine for days.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Just big spoonfuls of it.
And there is actually a really important reason for using these caterpillars in cocaine studies. So the Colombian government were considering releasing thousands of these moths into areas where guerrilla fighters produce cocaine to destroy the crops.
No.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
So they literally can just... Oh, wow. Oh,
yeah.
My God.
That's insane. What?
It's amazing, isn't it?
Taking down cocaine farmers with caterpillars. That's delightful.
There, isn't it? How lovely. But... unfortunately, there are a few issues with this. So this is from the Smithsonian Magazine. Gonzalo Andrade, a biology professor and butterfly researcher at Bogota's National University, raises a very good point that only one or two of the five species of coca plant that grows in Colombia can be processed into cocaine. So if the moths go out and eat other species, they'll
destroy it. Yeah,
they could destroy legal coca crops that are used by indigenous communities for traditional purposes.
Oh, okay.
So for that reason, isn't necessarily a good plan, but they might not eat the other ones because it might be the cocaine that they like. But it's not clear. But environmental groups also disagreed with the plan because while the moths are native to the region, if you drop huge populations of moths into an area,
it's not generally
throw the ecosystem out of control.
It will ruin everything.
All right, we won't weaponize insects. We get it. We shouldn't.
Not this time.
But yeah, that plan was first proposed in 2005 and brought up again in 2015 after the Colombian president agreed to stop using this horrible carcinogenic pesticide.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And I'm not sure where it is now because it's I think people are still researching it to find out if it's feasible. Mm. It's environmentally, it sounds like it's probably not, but it's such a nice idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On paper, it's so lovely.
So lovely.
I love it so much.
So that's... those are some cocaine studies, quite interesting, but let's move on to some different drugs. In fact, all of the drugs. So, I mean, you've both definitely heard of or seen pictures of the messed up webs that spiders produce.
Yes.
Yeah. After a NASA research group in the mid-90s gave them a whole host of drugs.
I forgot it was NASA.
I didn't realize it was NASA, and now I really want to know why they did it.
Well, it was very famously NASA, that at least that's the information that goes around. And it is true that they did these studies. In 1995, they gave spiders a whole host of drugs, including marijuana, caffeine, LSD, benzedrine, which is an amphetamine, and chloral hydrate, which is a sedative. But it wasn't NASA that started these experiments, although that's what a lot of the kind of lore around them is. And I've got a lot of information for you on this, and it's from a really good Vice article, this first part. Anyway, it was a German zoologist, Hans Peters, that administered many of these drugs for the first time to spiders by putting them in sugar water.
Mm.
And this was in 1948. Why do you think he wanted to do this? Now, with considering why scientists might want to give animals drugs.
Does it have to do with trying to get, like, silk production from the spiders, possibly?
That's such a good shot.
I don't know.
You're not incorrect for a later purpose, actually, which is which means you at least, you've got that. You're thinking more like a scientist. Hans Peters doesn't sound like, he's a zoologist. I'm not sure how much I can actually call him a scientist, to be honest. Okay, because
I'm so excited.
The reason he didn't want to see how the drugs affected mechanisms in the spider, he wanted to not stay up late. Okay, he wanted to make a documentaries about the spiders building their webs, but they primarily do this in the early hours of the morning, like 2 to 5 a.m.
Oh my goodness!
No.
So we hope that by giving them drugs, it would disrupt their sense of time. And get them to build webs earlier in the day.
Are you ever so lazy about getting up that you accidentally make NASA give drugs to spiders? Has that ever happened to you?
What a butterfly effect right there. Some guy didn't want to stay up late, so NASA gave drugs to spiders.
Wow.
I hate it so much.
So ridiculous.
Who thinks that's okay?
What? It was the 1940s.
Oh, okay. I mean,
so it's a very strange time for science. Anyway, it just so you know, it didn't make them change the time. They made their webs. They were still doing it in the middle of the night, but now they weren't very good webs. So Peters couldn't use them anyway.
Oh, that's perfect. That's the ending we all deserved, isn't it?
Right. But the pharmacologist that helped Peters with the project, Peter Witt, was still interested in the research. This is where what you said, Tom, comes in. He wanted to understand more about the silk production of the spiders. But he also, and this seemed to be the thing that took over, had this crazy idea that if you could feed the blood of people on drugs to spiders,
it would be a drugs test.
Yeah, those spiders, they build a drug specific web to help you identify the drug they'd taken.
No! No! I love the idea of like a Charlotte's Web situation where like a spider goes into the corner and is just like, this dude's smoking pot real.
Yeah.
Wow.
Imagine that they like the drug, spiders just spell out the drug name in the fucking web.
Yeah, exactly. The web just says heroin.
Just in a lab, you've got your spiders just watching. Oh my god.
I know, how bonks is that?
And then there's a movie about a spider who's not a narc and who like befriends everyone and is like, all right, you're good, you're clear.
That's so good. Okay. So Witt continued the research, not just giving the spiders sugar water now, but also the blood and urine of people who had taken drugs. We now understand this doesn't work, okay? There wasn't... You have to give the spiders actual drugs. They're not potent enough in your blood and urine. Otherwise, people would be drinking people's blood to get drugs, right?
Yeah, if it's not being absorbed. But also, again, you know, we have to add the addendum of, like, it's the middle of the 20th century. We're still figuring stuff out, kind of.
Yeah, a lot of amazing discoveries made around this time, and also some idiots. that's so unfair. That's so unfair.
I mean, is it unfair?
This is actually slightly off topic, but Witt also gave spiders around the same time urine from people with schizophrenia, because at the time there was an idea that schizophrenic people had hallucinogenic compounds in their systems. And that's what made them schizophrenic.
Oh,
wow. So
Witt and other researchers from a Swiss mental hospital found no connection between the urine of schizophrenics and web building changes. But they did find that spiders hated the taste of schizophrenic urine specifically. Other urine was fine.
What?
Schizophrenic urine, they don't like.
Do we know why?
No, I don't think we do.
Wow.
I wonder if there are other factors of being in a mental institution in the middle, in like the 1950s.
That might, yeah,
possibly.
But also, like,
did they give them urine from other patients with different disorders? I don't think they did. So,
but I would someone repeat this research in 2021? Maybe not. We may never know.
I don't think so. I don't think this would pass any kind of ethical committee.
And shouldn't.
No.
Oh my god.
Oh my god. Wow.
So eventually Witt's work was discontinued because it wasn't finding anything. But NASA picked it up again in the 90s. So if you look at those very famous images, Witt... Okay, those very famous images of the spider's webs on drugs.
I love the idea that the person at NASA is just like Witt with like a mustache, and he's like, oh man, this guy's research is pretty good. We should take a look at it again.
This man was a genius. Let's keep going.
I think they were hoping, because they had evidence that the drugs affected the spiders, I think the hope was that they would be able to find something out about human behavior, right?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And if you look at those very famous images, which are probably actually Witt's images rather than NASA's, even though they're accredited to NASA.
Oh.
Interesting.
What you see is that it's the sedative, chloral hydrate, and caffeine webs that easily come out the worst with like little to no structure.
Right.
And people will see this image, especially the caffeine one, and take this as like this huge kind of warning that you shouldn't be drinking caffeine. You know, this is what it's worse than all other drugs. But the truth is that spiders produce a hormone called octopamine, and they produce a lot of it. Mammals might produce a very small amount, but we're not sure. And octopamine can work in combination with caffeine to overload insects and spiders and kill them.
Oh, wow.
Even at naturally occurring quantities of caffeine, which obviously if for humans it wouldn't affect them in the same way because we don't produce that hormone in the same way. So Linda Rayner, an entomologist at Cornell University who studies spiders, says that these WIT and NASA studies are really only valuable in the context of understanding the innate web-building behaviors of spiders.
Right.
And how that messing with the spider's brain chemistry changes or disrupts their web-building movements. So that's it.
Wow. It's so interesting.
It is, isn't it? All of these studies, I think people are hoping to get some like real deep understanding often of like how humans are affected by drugs. But it's just, especially in insects, you're never, ever going to get that.
No, yeah.
It's so weird that the weirdest thing wasn't giving drugs to insects. It was spiders drinking urine for me was the weirdest part. I did not expect us to go there.
Yeah. Wow.
But we're not done. So I've got one last deep one and then I'm going to do some quick fires. So I've talked a lot about creepy crawlies, insects and spiders on drugs. And from what I can tell, most recreational drug studies have been done on these kind of creatures. I would guess because they're easier to obtain and to treat and the research is like less ethically dubious.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
But morals will not stop humans from doing stupid shit. And that's how we got elephants on acid.
I was so hoping you would talk about elephants on acid. Yes.
Oh, I'm seeing them this weekend at Brooklyn Steel. They're opening.
Very good. So on Friday, the 3rd of August in 1962, Warren Thomas, the director of Lincoln Park Zoo in Oklahoma City, fired a cartridge syringe containing 297 milligrams of LSD into the rump of Tusco the elephant. Thomas and his colleagues wanted to see if LSD could induce musther in elephant. So musther, I don't know if I'm saying that right. That's how it's spelled. M-U-S-T-H.
It might be must.
It's a temporary state of like madness, of very high aggression in male elephants. Their testosterone levels become on average 60 times greater than normal, and it seems to be for reproductive reasons. So they say that they wanted to induce this in Tusco, but probably they also were just curious to see what would happen because it was the 60s. So they gave Tusco, so they gave him LSD, and they gave him a dose 3,000 times more than a human would typically take.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, absolutely brutal. I mean, it just didn't go well. Poor Tusco apparently just ran around his pen trumpeting for a few minutes and then he collapsed. Yeah. Oh. They tried to revive him with antipsychotics, but he just died about an hour later.
Oh my god. Oh,
I know, isn't that awful?
Did nobody think maybe 3,000 times?
I know, truly idiots.
Too much. Like, maybe five to start off with. Maybe even less than that.
I believe their thinking was that LSD is very, very rarely fatal. Or if at that point, I believe people thought that it wasn't at all. And so they assumed, oh, we can just give him an insanely high dose. The paper they published concluded that it appears that the...
I forgot it was science for a second. This is just manslaughter at a certain point.
I know, it's ridiculous. So the paper they published concludes that it appears that the elephant is highly sensitive to the effects of LSD.
No, fucking shit.
It appears that the human immune system is highly sensitive to bullets. We find in this study, it turns out. Oh my god.
Wow.
3,000 times. That's so much LSD also. much LSD.
Wow. That was really dumb.
Literally, the only beneficial thing they found from this is I was about to say that elephants are more sensitive to LSD, but that's just not true because they gave him a lethal dose, so that it was useless. I don't even think he got fired for this, which is insane.
What?
This is
wild. How are
people
not losing their jobs for killing an entire elephant? What?
I really want to read this paper and see how they try to phrase it to be not absolutely
out
of this world.
Like, did the research ever go any further than this? Or was it just like...
So I did read that maybe a decade later, they gave two more elephants LSD. I think it was different researchers. And I can't remember if they died or not, but it was not good.
Didn't go well.
Yeah.
Oh, no. my goodness.
But there you go. I've covered a couple of different studies in a bit of detail. Some of the most interesting ones, but I'm going to end on a quick fire of a few more.
So excited.
Some of these are not just humans giving animals drugs. Some of them are self-administered by the animals.
Go on.
Are we about to talk like elephants taking alcohol and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, at the end, if you have any more, you should add them, but I'll just go through these ones. So, mice given large doses of speed, so methamphetamine, show long-lasting changes in communication pathways in the brain that seem to cause withdrawal and cravings for the drug that persist for months, which would be the equivalent of years to humans. This actually does have use in understanding addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, yeah.
And withdrawal in humans, and that's why these studies were done. Mice are very good model organisms and are used very regularly even now. So this one seemed good and makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
In Tasmania, legal opium farmers have a problem with wallabies entering the fields, getting extremely high from eating the poppies and making crop circles. They get super high and then they stomp around the fields and crush everything.
Oh, that's so cute.
Yeah.
And a huge problem for the farmers, but really adorable.
Fruit flies with the mutation cheap date are much, much more susceptible to alcohol than other flies. They exhibit drop.
They called it cheap date.
Yeah. Oh, man. There were some really, really bad fruit fly mutation names. A lot of them were found in like the 80s and 90s. So I think they were not necessarily politically correct. Those fruit flies with the cheap date mutation, they exhibit drunken behavior similar to humans, and they're being used to study the genetic factors that could influence alcoholism.
Oh,
which does make sense. But anybody who ever researches that is just going to have to write the name of that mutation forever.
Yes, unfortunately. I did a TikTok on the names of fruit fly genes and mutations, and there are some really wild ones.
Missed that. I'm going to have to go and watch that after this.
So the last one is pen-tailed tree shrews in Malaysia. They excessively eat giant flower clusters of the betrum plant, palm, which produce alcohol with concentrations of up to 3.8%, so similar to beer.
Mm.
But they don't get drunk because they convert a lot of the alcohol to a compound called ethyl glucuronide, which ends up in their fur.
Interesting.
Whoa.
So humans also produce ethyl glucuronide, but only at a very small amount.
Mm.
The amount that's found in the shrew's fur would be the equivalent to someone who was very, very severely alcoholic.
Wow. Oh my goodness. That's so interesting.
But they just eat that because it's part of their normal diet. They're not doing it to get high like the wallabies.
Yeah. Yeah. To go make crop circles.
The wallabies are really just having a good time.
Yeah.
Although this is something I do know just from general knowledge, not from researching, that birds will eat fermented fruits. Actually, a lot of different animals, monkeys, like some rodents, will eat fermented fruits to get drunk.
That's so interesting. That aspect of all of these is definitely the most interesting to me. The fact that like the caterpillars that seem to be immune, and sort of how naturally other animals have the concept of recreational drugs as being like a natural part of how they exist in the world. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And
so my final notes are that humans have given animals lots of recreational drugs over the past 100 years or so, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for terrible ones. And it's probably going to continue, but at least in the advent of better animal protection laws, we can assume that the good outweighs the bad at the moment. And at the very least, like you say, Tom, we can take some comfort in knowing that sometimes animals want to get high.
Don't do drugs, kids. That's also the addendum.
That's not my addendum. Do drugs.
Oh.
Do not listen to anybody here when it comes to taking drugs. Thank you.
Do you know what my favorite recreational drug is?
What is it, Tom?
It's math.
Oh, God. All right, go on. Get on with it.
Believe it or not, this story also has spider piss in it. It doesn't. It does have one callback, though. One person, one organization that we'll come back to. But anyway, so the question that I was asked is, how many digits of pi do we need? And without, I first want to ask what you think that question means and how you would answer that.
So my understanding of pi is that it never ends, right?
Yep.
And that all of the works of Shakespeare can be found within it.
Yeah, every single person's phone number can be found somewhere in pi. Because it's a never-ending and never-repeating string of numbers, isn't it? Yeah.
I know literally nothing about pi. I don't even know why you would need pi as a number at all. So this question is completely beyond me.
Figure out something about circles.
So
lead us in.
Yeah, I'll be completely honest. I think in dealing with pi in, like, you know, math classes, it's very easy to forget, like, what it is. When I was doing research on this, just seeing that, like, pi is just the circumference of a circle divided by the diameter. And I was like, why did no one say it so simply as that? I feel like once we sort of use it so practically in math that we sometimes forget. It's basically, yeah, it describes the relationship of a circle and how that functions. And so it's useful for a lot of things. So like you all said, pi is irrational, which means that it can't be a fraction of integers. And it's also transcendental, which is a classification of numbers that I find, it's a beautiful name. It basically means that it's non-algebraic, which means that you can't use a finite number of polynomials to create it. Basically, it's a very strange number, and like you all said, it is infinite. That has been proven. So some of the first records of pi were found in Babylon and Egypt between 1900 and 1600 BC.
Whoa!
And they estimated it to be 3.125, which is wrong, but also amazing.
Like, not too wrong.
No.
So they were looking for pi because they were thinking about circles, right? It wasn't we're just gonna, this random number, we're just gonna have a get a crack at
no,
it.
Yeah, yeah. it's a very, yeah, it's you know, it's at once very natural but also very mathematic, right? Because it has to deal with circles, which are both in nature but also, like, a perfect circle is a very mathematical concept, right? Something that is, like, infinitely curved and perfect. So there's a beautiful graph on Wikipedia that is the record approximations of pi, like how many digits we have over history been able to figure out. And it's amazing because it starts off in, like, 2000 BC, and it continues and it slowly grows up and up and up. And then when it hits around 1950, it just skyrockets. So I had to double check this because the world record for how many digits of pi we've calculated, the record was last broken August 16th of 2021, which was just a handful of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it is 62.8 trillion digits of pi.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
I thought it was going to maybe at most be billions. That's too big of a number for me to comprehend. Yeah.
And so the problem is that calculating them isn't a linear operation, at least not yet. We can't calculate them linearly, so the more digits you calculate, the more time it takes. And so at a certain point, it does become something that you need multiple computers that are optimized to work, you know, in parallel to be able to do operations like this. But all that aside, the real question is, how many digits of pi do we realistically need? And so one barometer for that is our friends at NASA. And the question is, how many digits of pi do NASA use?
Interesting.
And I am asking you all that.
Oh, 10.
5. It's going to be so dumb, isn't it? It's going to be 3.
I just can't, even though NASA, I know that NASA have to do things incredibly precisely when they're doing like rocket ship weights and stuff like that. It has to be like crazy, crazy, crazy precise. But even then, I can't imagine that they would go digit-wise really, really far
any
in.
Any more than like 20, surely.
There's just no reason. There's no reason.
That is the answer. There is no reason. So Mark Raymond, who is the chief engineer of NASA's Dawn mission, said that for JPL's, which is the Jet Propulsion Lab, for JPL's highest accuracy calculations, which are for interplanetary navigation, we use 3.14159265358973, which is just 15 decimal points.
Wow.
Hey, we literally... Caroline and I I said 10, they said 20. We got it between us.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
If we average all of our intellect together, we make one JPL employee.
Functioning brain cell. Yay.
I could work for NASA.
Together, me and you.
We could work. We would have to be. It's a package deal. Yeah. NASA, if you're out there, it's a package deal. You get one of us, you get all of us. So if you remember that chart that I mentioned that talked about the history of how many digits of pi we were able to calculate, 15 digits we were able to calculate in the 1400s. So
no.
At that point, we had enough digits of pi to get us to interplanetary travel. And so when we think about what kind of accuracy we need, Mark Raymond says that if you were to draw a circle around the Earth, the distance of the Voyager probe, which is 25 billion miles away, which is the farthest human object that has ever left Earth, and you had 15 digits of pi and you calculated that circle, the error would be off by 1.5 inches using 15 digits of pi. So that is more than enough for that kind of accuracy. But we can take that concept and ask a bigger question, which is, how many digits of pi would you need for a circle the size of the universe? Because theoretically, that is the maximum number of digits of pi that you would need.
1,000.
Yeah!
So if we had a circle the size of the observable universe to the accuracy of a quark, how many digits of pi would we need for that?
Not as many as we have. I know this. I know this for sure.
It's going to be something so dumb, like 100, isn't it?
It's somewhere between 15 and the many trillion.
Yeah.
It's somewhere in there that we've mentioned.
I'm going to say 150, because it's going to be something dumb like that.
500.
So this is, it's so messed up. The answer... The answer is 45 digits of pi.
Oh my god.
Is how many we need. And again, going back to that, the concept of the time scale, we were able to calculate 45 digits of pi in the 1600s.
Wow. So here's my next question.
Yes.
Since we only need that many, why do we keep wanting to find out more? Because that must take up so much computer power and stuff like that, and so many people to figure it out, like, why?
And my question is, if we only need that many, why don't we take the ones from pi and give some to the other numbers?
Right, it's just inconsiderate and selfish of pi, really.
We don't need to worry about the billionaires. We need to worry about the trillionaires, like pi.
Like pi.
I wrote down your question, Caroline, is why do we keep counting? And I just saw it again. I just had this huge existential crisis. that. So from a purely theoretical point of view, that actually isn't necessarily how many digits of pi we need, because we could also have, for instance, a slice of pizza the size of the universe. Right? Or like a hemisphere the size of the universe. So in theory, there could be, or even just a very, 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 very small angle, right? So there are theoretical reasons beyond physical reasons. Oh boy, wow, that hurt my brain to say out loud.
That's such a big sentence.
But arguably, they are pretty impractical. But there are, this is the interesting thing. So aside from mathematical clout, another great reason to have them And this is a quote from Emma Haruko Iwao from NPR. And the quote goes, but she says, it'll come in handy for anyone studying the features of pi to better understand the number through statistical analysis. So large numbers of pi are useful for a handful of things. One of them is to test supercomputers. Because it's a number that you can confirm that needs a huge operation to do them. And that is not something that you come by every day, right? Something that takes work to do, but that you can confirm right away because people know the number. And so honestly, it's more interesting from a statistical point of view, which is funny because that's what you all have mentioned as at the very beginning as what comes to your mind when you think of pi, because while we've proved that it's infinite, we haven't proved that it's normal, meaning that every number appears an equal number of times, right? So it's not random because the numbers stay the same, but it's normal in terms of theoretically every number appears in it the equal number of times, but that hasn't been proven. That's just been the case however many trillions of times so far. So from a mathematical, statistical, and also, I guess, philosophical perspective, we do need those digits of pi.
Wow. Can we not be reasonably certain that it is a normal number? I know it's not proven because we can, and it can never be proven because we can never get to the end.
Right.
Mm. But in,
well,
in, or maybe
can
we
get to the end?
Well, with this one weird trick. Well, so the way we would prove that would not be to get to the end, but to somehow maybe, you know, maybe on the second trillion, we notice a pattern or something. So we could either A, notice a counterexample to prove that it isn't normal somehow, or we could just be able to reason with it a different way. But yeah, I mean, you who knows? We don't know. But yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
And and I have another question. So it's pi is the circumference of a circle divided by its diameter.
Mm-hmm.
So the way people back in the 1400s calculated pi was by doing that maths. And I assume just doing like long division, right?
Yeah. So in the 1600s, my favorite, for me, the most intuitive way to think about pi is, or how you would calculate it, is if you have a circle, right? Like a perfect circle, and then you have a square on the outside of it, and then a square on the inside of it. You know that the circumference is between the small square and the big square, right? So if you have like, it's perfectly inside a big square and a small square is perfectly inside the circle. And then if you change it from a square to a pentagon.
I'm good.
You have a pentagon on the...
That,
okay, I'm I apologize.
No, it's not like, well, I mean, it's maths.
It's just
maths.
No,
yeah, yeah. You basically, what they literally did was they took a square, like a four-sided object, then a five-sided, then a six-sided, and they just kept adding to get closer and closer to a circle.
I see. So you're telling me they could only do that 45 times because it doesn't actually seem that hard, is what I'm saying. I get why trillions is difficult and needs computers.
So,
but why is 45?
Why was that the number? Did they just give up at that
point? So you get diminishing returns with each side. Each side only gets you so much more accuracy, right? From a square to from a triangle to a square, it gets, you know, it's much closer to a circle. But as you add more sides, you get less and less. You don't get like one digit back each time. So you get diminishing returns, which is why the numbers get harder to calculate. Yeah.
Okay, I have another question. Why can't it just be done by long division?
It's done by a mathematical formula. It makes no sense to me. It is totally inscrutable.
I just don't get why. We know if you have a circumference, which is a distance, right? Yeah. In centimeters, say.
Yep.
And the
diameter. Yes.
I see what you mean now. Yeah.
And it's centimeters. Why can't you just keep going? Why can't you just do the normal, like, really simple division maths?
You could just keep going, keep crossing out those numbers and going back. Yeah.
Because a circle, and this is, I might get something philosophically wrong, a circle is a mathematical concept that is physically impossible because it's infinitely curved and it has an infinite number of sides to it. So therefore, Like, if you take a square, you measure all four sides. If you take a pentagon, you measure all five sides. If you have a circle, you have to measure all infinite sides, which is impossible.
It's such a bullshit answer, but I get it.
That's why it's impossible.
Okay, so the circumference, the number of the circumference is an unknown in this case.
We're really being tested right now.
I guess all estimates of circumferences are estimates. None of them are real.
From
a mathematical perspective. In real life, no measurement is ever perfectly accurate, right? Oh boy.
This is getting real heavy.
This is hurting my real brain. Heavy.
Infinity, I'm sure, will be a main topic to hurt our brains one day. But just know that we only need 15. 15 is fine. 15 will do.
15's fine. 45 at most. Currently,
NASA only needs 15. I probably only need 5. We're good.
People figure out more for clout.
What do you need 5 for, Tom?
What are you doing?
Hey, I work with pretty big circles in my profession. I'll have you know. Actually, that's another weird detail is the digits of pi that various programming languages use. So I think C uses 20. And it's like, why do you need all those? You don't
why
need that many.
Why are you trying to be
pi.
Better than NASA?
You're trying to be better than NASA.
Wow. That was super interesting. I really, really enjoyed that. My brain does hurt now, but I did really enjoy that.
I feel somehow smarter and dumber than I did before.
I'm like humbled with my intelligence right now. And on that note, I think we'll take it back to a really nice and easy topic for everybody to understand. Drama.
Yeah!
Drama.
Oh, I love talking about
really
drama.
Grown men being bitches to each other on the internet. Let's go.
Oh, this is two men. Okay, this is even more exciting because I actually don't know what this
you
is.
Don't know. Okay, so I thought this would be a safe one to talk about because it's art. And we're all scientists here, so. But for anybody who doesn't know, I do painting on the side. So this is kind of like my world here. This is stuff that I'm actively looking at all the time because I think it's absolutely fantastic. Do you know who Anish Kapoor and Stuart Semple are?
I know the name do. Anish Kapoor.
So Anish Kapoor is a very, very famous British artist. He was knighted by the Queen in 2013. He's got some really, really famous pieces of artwork. One he calls, or it is called Cloud Gate, which is in Chicago.
Oh, that's
it's the Big
the bean.
Bean. Yeah, it's the Bean, which Anish Kapoor hates that it's called the Bean by people, which
and
is wonderful.
And that's why I call it the
and
Bean.
That's why we do it, because nobody likes Anish Kapoor, and you will learn why. I feel like, Tom, you might know. Oh, is it all slotting
man,
in for everybody now?
If it's the man that made the bean, then this is about Vanta Black.
It is. Yes.
Which actually, this is a science topic, really.
But also, there's grown-ass men swearing at each other and being petty motherfuckers on the internet. So I'm so sorry for swearing. Feel free to bleep all of it out.
I've sworn a lot during this, so I think you're fine.
So in 2014, Surrey Nanosystems released a material called Vanta Black. At the time, it was the blackest black material. It absorbed 99.965% of light. If you look at it, it literally looks like a 2D object. It's insane.
It looks amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
You've just seen pictures of it.
Yeah. Yeah, let alone what it must look like in real life.
Yeah.
So yeah, super absorbent of light, the blackest black at the time. And Anish Kapoor was like, hey, that's really cool. I want to make art out of it. It was used in engineering. So Anish Kapoor started using it for his artwork. He made a few somewhat well-known pieces. He painted a circle on a floor, you know, fun stuff.
Who among us has not?
So in 2016, after a few years of using the material, he did a big dick move. To put it lightly, he struck a deal with Surrey Nanosystems. He bought the exclusive rights of Vanta Black for use in art. Nobody else was allowed to use the world's blackest black in their art anymore. You might imagine other artists were a bit like, what? Why would you do that thing? That's a rubbish thing to do. I've got a quote from another artist here. This is Christian Fur.
Also, to not have even made it himself.
No,
right?
He didn't even make it himself. He had, like, no real claim to it other than he'd used it a few times.
Liked using it.
Yeah, yeah, that was it. So another artist called Christian Fur said this, and I quote, "I've never heard of an artist monopolizing a material. All the best artists have had a thing for pure black. This black is like dynamite in the art world. We should be able to use it. It isn't right that it belongs to one man."
How could a color, how could you have a color?
Literally. So other artists have claimed colors before, like they've claimed shades of blue and things like that. But nobody's ever claimed the blackest black.
They shouldn't be... the other artists who claim those other colours shouldn't have been allowed to. You can't have a colour.
It's ridiculous. And many other artists were like, "You're just being greedy, my dude." Basically.
It feels so counter. I you know, maybe this is too hippy dippy, but it just feels so counter to art to be like, mine.
You are going
to
agree with this further after I tell you the reasons why Anish Kapoor gave for taking the rights. So this was his reasoning.
Boy.
Again, direct quote from him. "Because it's a collaboration, because I'm wanting to push them to a certain use for it. I've collaborated with people who make things out of stainless steel for years, and that's exclusive." Going on, he essentially says that he wanted to realize Vanta Black's artistic potential. And according to him, the only way that he could realize Vanta Black's artistic potential was to be the only person who could do that.
That's
literally, it doesn't make sense. It's absolute bullshit.
Yeah, in that one sentence.
That's ridiculous.
He's just like debunked his own reasoning there.
Yeah.
So he just made other people like him even less after saying that. This is where our good friend Stuart Semple comes in. So he was also upset about this, obviously. So he turned around in 2016, at the very end of 2016, and said, "I'm going to create a different pigment." He created the world's pinkest pink, and he released it to the public for anybody to use with this disclaimer on his website. Again, reading this line by line, quote for quote, "By adding this product to your cart, you confirm that you are not Anish Kapoor. You are in no way affiliated to Anish Kapoor. You are not purchasing this item on behalf of Anish Kapoor or an associate of Anish Kapoor. To the best of your knowledge, information, and belief, this paint will not make its way into the hands of Anish Kapoor."
Chef's kiss all around.
Chef's kiss, fantastic,
perfect.
Wonderful. He thought he would sell like one or two things of this pigment. It was more like creating an art piece in itself by posting it online for everybody to have access to it. Instead of getting one or two orders, he got thousands, which is wonderful. We love that. Sadly, Anish Kapoor did get his hands on it.
Oh, of course he did.
Because people on the internet are dicks. And he posted a lovely, really classy photo on Instagram. He had dipped his middle finger into the pigment and then took a photo of himself swearing at the pigment with the pigment on his finger as a huge fuck you to Stuart Semple and anybody who supported him, basically.
I will also say he paid him money, like either indirectly or indirectly, Anish Kapoor paid Stuart Semple money to then flip him off.
Yeah, yeah, it's ridiculous. So the feud goes on a little bit. In 2017, Stuart Semple made his own version of like the blackest paint that he could. He worked with a lot of other artists, a lot of other people, and at the end of 2017. He came out with Black 2.0. It's not as good as Vanta Black, but it's a lot cheaper. It's a lot more accessible. Anybody can, or like the pigment is much easier to make. Vanta Black is ridiculously expensive to produce and you can't produce it in large quantities. Whereas Black 2.0, you could. So people kind of forgave it for not being so good because it was so accessible and so cheap. He made other products. He made something called Diamond Dust, which is apparently the world's most glittery glitter. He made Black 3.0. He's made things like watercolor palettes using these pigments. It's all super accessible. You can currently buy Black 3.0 for £21.
That's very good.
Oh, wow.
It's only 150ml, like, tube of it. But again, super accessible. Anybody can buy it. And at that point, Anish Kapoor kind of shuts up, which is, we appreciate that. But there is a tiny little bit more at the end of this. So as of 2019, Vanta Black is no longer the blackest material.
Ooh.
Dun, dun, dun.
Wait, but I thought Anish Kapoor was realizing it to its full potential this whole time. Or was he too busy making fights on Instagram and flipping people off?
So in 2019, a material was developed at MIT. This one absorbs 99.995% of light.
Wow.
It was unveiled as part of an art installation. I think it was at the New York Stock Exchange. It was by an artist, Dimut Straib. He's a German-Italian artist living in America. The piece is called The Redemption of Vanity. It's a diamond dipped into this new substance and put on display. It's fantastic.
Wait, say that again. What's it called? Sorry.
It's called The Redemption of Vanity.
I really want to look at it.
Yeah.
Honestly, the photos are fantastic because it's like against a black screen.
Yeah.
And all you see is just this like blacker thing in the middle of it. It's
cool. The most like startling thing about these things is that like when you paint a three-dimensional object, it looks two-dimensional because
2D. It's absolutely insane.
It looks like someone's just gone into Photoshop.
Yeah.
Cut out like the image out. It's
literally. So there was also a statement that went along with this. So this is, again, a direct quote from the artist and the team. The project can also be interpreted as a statement against British artist Anish Kapoor's purchase of exclusive right to a formula of carbon nanotubes as a material for artwork.
Mm.
Straib and Wardler use different composition of carbon nanotubes, which will be available for any artist to use.
Woo!
Yay!
And also, on a final note, if you're wondering what Stuart Semple's doing these days, 3 weeks ago, he released The World's Blackest Ink as well. So he's still going. He's still making a lot of money. He donates a lot of it to charity and things like that. And he makes as much of it as accessible to other artists as possible. Whereas Anish Kapoor is just existing now somewhere. I didn't check what he was doing at the moment, actually.
Realizing it to its full potential, obviously.
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So that is my favorite drama from the art world. A lot of people
have
talked
amazing.
About it. So I'm so sorry to anybody who's listening who has heard this story before. I love it to pieces.
I got some good new details out of that. And actually, while I was looking for the picture of Anish Kapoor flipping off the pinkest pink, I found this article about the whitest white, which came out earlier this year.
I missed that. And it, oh my goodness.
Oh boy.
It actually doesn't reflect at like at quite as much as the blackest black absorbs, but it reflects 98.1% of light.
Whoa. That's insane.
And the idea is they hope to use the paint to keep buildings cooler without air conditioning.
Yeah.
Mm.
So that's so very cool.
Because an interesting thing about Vanta Black, again, which was why it wasn't great as an art material, is that if you paint something with Vanta Black, it will start to heat up because of how much light it absorbs.
Oh.
Right. Whereas the paint that Stuart Semple made will not do that, thankfully. You won't be getting
hot
artwork.
I feel like both the like technical side beat Anish Kapoor and like the common folk side of things beat Anish Kapoor. It was just like the power of the spite was so productive and beautiful.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It did create like Stuart Semple doing a lot of good things out of it. It's just a shame that it did take two, again, fully grown men just being kind of petty for it to happen.
Yep, really.
I love it. I love it.
How do we end this show? I forget.
How do we end this?
How do we end this?
Let me pull up the last episode. How did we do that?
I think we just go... We just say like that's it.
Oh right.
Cool, folks.
So does anyone have any what the fuck did I say last time? Plugs or what's it called? Plugs or something else? Plugs or shout outs. Does anyone so as we come to a close, does anyone have any plugs or shout outs this week?
I'm gonna shout out myself, as always.
Do it.
You can follow me on TikTok and it's
Caroline the Bug.
Or on all of my other socials as well. It's
Caroline the Bug.
Almost everywhere. You'll be able to find me.
Oh, lovely. I will plug my TikTok at
Dr. Big Science Energy.
You can follow me on Twitter at Ella Hubba, which is my name. I don't have consistent branding and I'm not changing it to Big Science Energy because I don't do, that's like my professional one where I follow like research papers and stuff, you know? and I want to give a shout out to Anish Kapoor. You're not, don't listen to this podcast. You're not allowed.
You're not welcome here.
You're listening to this podcast. Like you. Be gone.
Your artwork's called The Bean. Shut up.
And you can find me at Tom Lum Person on all of them. Managed to get them all.
Well
so.
Done.
Yeah.
Is your username not too long for Twitter?
No. Oh, and it has capitalization, so people don't call me Lumperson, as the majority. Quantitatively, in this world, most people think of me as Lumperson, and I have to live with that fact, and that's cool.
Even in my head.
Lumperson.
Have you not heard that, Ella?
No, I knew your name was Tom Lum, so I heard it as Tom Lum Person, and I always say it like that. But the idea that your name is Lumpy...
Lumperson.
here's some real tea.
Son of Lumper.
Here's some real tea. I'll say real quick before we come up with an end for this episode. did a podcast where they talked about my B Tic Tac, and they called me Lumperson. They didn't bother to. They also did not contact me at all. I found this out through a chat message on a live. Someone was like, "I saw that article and I knew about it." And I was like, "Excuse me." They like link to it. They talk about it in the episode.
Wow.
Someone made art for that episode. That's like, it's like a picture of a beehive. And it's like, you did all that work. And not only did you not contact me, you didn't
say my name correctly.
Well, all I had to do was click on my profile to see it's Tom Lum. But
yeah, whatever. That's bad.
Oh my God. That's awful.
I mean, that's just kind of, it is awful, but it also is the internet for you.
It's very internet-y, yeah.
Someone, one of my friends sent me, some of my posts have been reposted on like a Swedish Instagram page, like with my, like, all my credits cut out and everything. Oh, we should end the podcast.
Yeah.
Let's just keep going.
Okay, let's end.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
As soon as I'm... Oh my God, Tom's gone absolutely AWOL.
Thanks.
That was wonderful. Thanks.
Thanks.
Watch me how we end it. Just all under
any pressure. Thanks.
As soon as I'm under any pressure, I just crumble. I can't do the intro. I can't do the outro.
We're going to have to get you a script, aren't we?
I really do need one.
Yeah, we need a tagline. We need an end tagline.
Did you learn something today?
Yeah. Nailed it. Oh my God, that was so good. You did so good. You're great.
There's something I really feel a bit like delirious almost.
I feel like it could be like, today we learned about biology, maths, and art. I think that's a little bit of everything.
Oh, that sounded so good. It's very cheesy. I like it.
It was so cheesy, but it's on brand.
Well, maybe for you. I'm very cool.
I've been called cool once.
God.
It would be cute to do like a sum up, like a little bit like,
yeah.
Today we learned about blah, blah, blah. And next time we're going to learn about everything.
Oh, that's a good idea. Today we learned about bees on cocaine, how long pie is for no reason, and and okay, someone who isn't me do it. Today we learned about, and then summarize the three things, and next time we're going to learn about everything.
Oh, I do like that. That's
I
nice.
I love that.
So this week we learned about all the drugs we've given to so many animals. We've learned about how many digits of pi we really don't need, or do we? And we've learned about the beautiful art that has come out of an extremely petty art feud. And next time, you can join us in learning everything. I hated it. I gotta practice that. I had some...
Let's Learn Everything is independently produced and hosted by Ella Hubber, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper. Editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum.
And so we have... I'm so sorry. Give me a second. I am so sorry. I should have had this number on hand. Give me a second.
It's okay.
It's not okay, Tom.
This is so unprofessional.
God.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. I can't believe you're doing this. Can't believe you've done this.
Oh, fuck. I can't believe you've done this.
Adam.
It happened.
Adam.
There's a whole generation underneath us that don't know what Vine is.
Yeah, but even they've like watched Vine compilations. Who doesn't watch Vine
compilations on TikTok?
That's how I started watching TikToks. I started watching TikTok compilations on YouTube because I didn't.
Oh no!
Wow!
Because I was like, well, I don't want to get onto TikTok.
Too cool for TikTok. God.
Then I'll have to start a podcast, and then this dumb idiot's gonna waste my time looking up a number.